Do you have weak, damaged hair? New Garnier Fructis hair filler systems fill hair with strength 7 layers deep. In just one use, you can reverse up to 1 year of damage to hair smoothness. The sulfate-free hair filler plus vitamin CG system gives you up to 79% stronger hair and up to 4 times less breakage. New Garnier Fructis hair filler is available now on Amazon and at Walmart, Target, Ulta, Drug, and select grocery stores.
This episode is brought to you by Tinder. With spring and festival season on the way, now is a fantastic time to get on Tinder and find your twin flame. You know, someone you can match festival outfits with, a boo with similar music tastes, or maybe someone who can introduce you to something new. Just make sure to throw a few likes their way, or you'll never know. Explore all of the possibilities for yourself on Tinder. It starts with a swipe. Download Tinder today.
Hello and welcome to Series 2, Episode 18 of Out with Susie Ruffle. Here we are, the final episode of the series, and what an episode it is. We have the marvellous Gok Wan on the show today. I am so excited for you to hear this one. It was recorded a couple of months ago, but I've saved it for the series finale. Firstly, thank you so, so much to people that got in touch after Rosie's episode last week, but I want to thank all of you that have listened to this series, who've written in, who have tweeted, who's Instagrammed about the show. I've appreciated it so, so much. Creating this little podcast during lockdown one was something that I hoped people would enjoy, and I hoped that that people would get a kick out of it. And I thought it would be really exciting for me to chat to people and interview people. And I've always been a chatter, as you, if you're listening, know this. And I've been sort of blown away by how successful these two little series that we've created this year has been. We've been podcast of the week in The Guardian, The Times and The iPaper. We're nominated for a Pod Bible Award. We're constantly getting feedback from both the UK and abroad from people that are really, really enjoying it. And I'm just delighted that this podcast that I record, as you well know, in this little cupboard office in my flat is meaning so much to so many people. And I want you to know it means an awful lot to me as well. Doing this podcast has certainly made what has been quite a tough year, 2020, you know, being a stand-up, all of my work completely stopped, all of the satisfaction and joy I get from being on stage performing just all went away, you know, in what felt like a matter of minutes, and it came back here and there, and then there were a couple of gigs and a couple of Zoom gigs, and then it all went away again. And having this podcast and chatting to these incredible people and knowing that people out there are enjoying it has really been the highlight, or one of the highlights of my 2020. So thank you so much for being part of that. I also need to thank the incredible guests that we've had this series. We've had Alan Carr, M&EK, Mae Martin, Travis Alabanza, Steph McGovern, Dennis O'Hare, Laura Checkley, the Reverend Richard Coles, Juno Dawson, Raven Smith, Rita Loy, Amro Al-Kadi, Jessica Fostercue, Stephen Bailey, Jem Brister, Lucy Spraggan, Rosie Jones, and today we have Gok Wan. Before we begin, as always, I will share some listener emails. Okay, let's start here. Thanks from Down Under. Oh, I just said we had listeners from all over the world, and that wasn't planned, but here we are. A message from Down Under. Dear Susie, I wanted to say it's been an absolute joy finding your podcast this year. I recently spent 2 years overseas, which were some of the best and most liberating years of my life. I felt like I could escape the self-hatred and internalised homophobia that I've struggled with so much growing up in Australia. And I found some amazing LGBTQIA+ friends. I came home in March to visit and got stuck here. I'm finding it really difficult being home. It's like I've slipped back into the closeted, lonely version of myself. I think one of the trickiest things is while my family is supportive, and I'm incredibly lucky and grateful for that, I feel like they can't understand the inner turmoil that it's caused me and how much pain. I think no matter where you grow up, learning to untangle the shame you absorb as an LGBTQ+ kid is so easily dismissed these days. So I found it so helpful to hear you and Laura Checkley talk about this in her episode. Your podcast has reassured me I'm not alone in my struggle and has given me a slice of hope that one day I'll find my people again. Sorry if this email sounds like a whinge, it doesn't, but I wanted to convey how important finding your podcast has been to me. Thanks so much, Susie. Cheers, Nick. Well, Nick, I am sure that one day you will find your people again. I hope that your lockdown in Australia is okay. I mean, I know that there's been lots of different types of lockdowns all across Australia. And I hope wherever you are, you're sort of doing okay. And I hope that you have a nice Christmas and that you find your people very soon. Hello, Susie. I've never done anything like this before, but I felt I needed to write to you and thank you and all of your amazing guests for the stories that you share on your podcast. I'm a 27-year-old cis female and I came out as bisexual earlier this year, feeling pretty late to the party. Growing up, I always knew I was attracted to girls. I just never addressed my feelings and thought it would be easier to pretend that that part of me didn't exist, since I liked boys too, so what did it matter if I only dated them? What I didn't realise was the years of hiding that part of me would lead to a deep shame and unhappiness. I wouldn't even watch queer films in case someone saw it on my recently watched list. Ridiculous, I know. Thankfully, after gaining the confidence to finally be myself, it's like someone flicked a switch and I've never been more loud and proud and kicked myself for not coming out sooner. Most of my friends and family have been incredibly supportive, and although my religious grandparents struggled at first, I know that they still love me. Coming out during a global pandemic hasn't been ideal, without Pride or bars open to meet other people in the community. Not like there's a gay bar in this small town. But because of this, online queer content like your podcast has been so important, and I just wanted to thank you for helping listeners like me to feel part of the community and not so alone. Wishing you a lovely Christmas, Tammy. And Tammy said that she's happy to share. Tammy, thank you so much for saying that. I'm so delighted that the podcast has made you feel part of the community, because of course you are. And, you know, I feel the same. I usually love going to Pride and love all that celebration stuff that we get to do every year. And obviously this year we've not been able to do it. But, you know, hopefully in 2021, with vaccines coming out and hopefully the world getting a lot healthier, we are all going to be able to see each other again and all be able to celebrate and celebrate the brilliant community. And that includes our allies. I know we have lots and lots of allies listening. You are very, very welcome to be part of that as well. Before I get to the wonderful chat with Gok, I want to let you know that we will have another series of the podcast. We're going to continue making it. And for that, I really need to thank everyone at Keep It Light, who are the production company that make the podcast, and they make it really, really easy for me, and they make it sound so good and so slick. And so I really appreciate them, because I know that this podcast isn't one of the ones that brings in the big money, but we think it's very, very important to make. So thank you to the guys at Keep It Light for that. I'm excited to begin recording in January some of the newer episodes, and I'm hoping that the next series will be out around February. Thank you again for listening. If you want to get in touch, please do. The email will be open in and out of series, so please get in touch if you feel like it. The email is hello@outwithsusieruffle.com. If you celebrate Christmas, I hope you have a gorgeous Christmas. If you don't celebrate Christmas, I hope that you have a nice little restful period where you get some you time. I also know, just a quick one, I also know that a lot of people that listen to the show are NHS workers or frontline workers, and I think it's really important that this Christmas I say a massive thank you to you guys for the incredible work that you've been doing. Okay, that's enough from me. Let's go to the brilliant chat that I had with Gok One. Hello, listener. I am so excited for today's guest. He was right at the top of my wish list when I first started this podcast. I am sure that Gok One doesn't really need an introduction to you, but I am going to give you one anyway. An acclaimed fashion stylist, presenter, cook, writer, and DJ, he burst onto our screens more than a decade ago with the brilliant How to Look Good Naked, and inspired women across the country to love their bodies and embrace themselves. It is still my Auntie Jackie's favourite TV show ever. You'll also know him from Gok's Fashion Fix, Fern and Gok Off the Rails This Morning, and Say Yes to the Dress, amongst others. It's Gok's warmth, enthusiasm, and charisma that made us all fall in love with him. Even the Queen likes him. He was awarded an MBE earlier this year for services to fashion and social awareness. And he is easily the most fashionable person I have ever met. Welcome to the show, Gok.
Susie, do you know what? Out of all of that incredible introduction, the fact that you're so well-dressed and really fashionable. Wow. You know what? Well, get the MBE. Susie, you called me fashionable.
Well, that's great. That means the next time I need a stylist, I can just ring you. Brilliant. How are you doing, Gok? I've got to say before we begin, I am loving Isolation Nation.
Thank you. you're really kind. I mean, I'm doing all right, actually. When the lockdown first happened, it was awful. I hated it. But I'm really rubbish with my own company. Like, I can't spend more than 3 minutes on my own. I even have to sometimes poo with the door open because I can't bear the thought of being on my own. And so when lockdown happened, it was a little bit like I'd been sentenced to go into prison. That's what it felt like, genuinely. And I was thinking, how am I going to get out of this situation? But then all of a sudden, I worked out that I just needed a few devices in my life, like cooking, for instance. Mm-hmm. But then also I started doing Isolation Nation. So a lot of people don't realise, but I've been DJing for years and years and years, professionally in clubs and festivals and stuff, and decided that I was going to take it online. And I think at the last weekend, over two sessions, we had over a million whatever that means, impressions, or reach, or whatever that is. I mean, that's probably three people, isn't it? But anyway, it's been remarkable.
That's amazing.
Thank you. But what's been lovely about it is that we've managed to raise money. I raised 10 grand last night for Stonewall.
Yeah, I saw.
7 grand for the NHS the other week. I've been selling Isolation Nation hoodies, like literally out the back of a van.
I love it.
Money for the Black Lives Matter campaign. So in fact, it's not just DJing and giving me something to do. It's also we've been raising cash. So I'm very proud of it, I have to say.
You should be. There have been several nights that my girlfriend and I have put it on in the background of the house, being like, oh, let's pop on Gok for a bit while we're like making tea and having dinner and just have it on in the background, having a few drinks. It's great.
What's really funny about that is that I treat it like I'm performing. So I kind of kitchen up and put on an outfit, decide how I'm feeling that day. And I literally dance solidly. So much so that this morning I woke up, got out of bed and collapsed because my right ankle had gone from dancing for 4 hours yesterday. This is no word of a lie. But then I've started to work out now, and it's taken 3 months, but everybody else is sat down at home having dinner. I'm the only wanker jumping around my kitchen like I've done 400 grams of speed.
Do you have a drink while you do it?
Oh, hammered. I've got what's become a really famous fish jug, which is called a guggle jug from Stoke-on-Trent, let me tell you.
Right.
And it makes a noise when you pour your drink. And I started using that at the beginning. And so if I do a set now where it isn't filled with vodka, you see the comments going up with people going, where's the fucking fish? So yes, yeah, so I get hammered all the way through, which is just an excuse to get drunk, really, because I do like drinking, you know.
Great. I mean, and also it gives us lot a chance to have a look at your kitchen, which I really enjoyed. I was like, oh, that's nice. I like what he's done there. That's very nice. You can have a really good nose in Gok's house without having to break in when he's not there. So that's great as well.
So odd because, like, you know, I never ever regard myself as a celebrity. I hate that word. I really hate the word celebrity. And so for me, it feels really, okay, so I'm from a northern council estate. I'm also mixed race, right? So my entire upbringing was based on people coming over. And regardless of who you were or what you've done, you might have murdered someone, you're still coming for dinner. And so it's just like, basically, this is the world I'm from. And so for me, it feels really normal to invite people into my home. I've got no problem with it. But a lot of my friends, like, well, you're not a bit funny about it, that people can see where you live. And I'm like, why? Just because I'm on the television, just because people, I do a job on the television, doesn't mean that I've got anything to, you know, to hide or anything. It's a bit of an odd concept. So for me, I don't mind people having a nose around the kitchen and having a look at what I've got. And I might even do my very own through the keyhole on one of the
people. Oh, please do.
Never know.
I want to see your wardrobe. I want to see how organised it is.
It's really organised.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
Yeah, I like organisation. I like things in a certain route. And so at the moment, because I've redone it during lockdown, and at the moment it's in colour order, genre order, and what time of day order. Or not. I have a what time of day department. So I kind of know if this is going to be loungewear. Okay, I kind of hate myself for saying this, but I know if it's going to be loungewear or if I know it's going to be nipping to the shops because we can now. And so I've got time of day departments.
I love it. Can I ask you another question? Because I heard on an interview that you did that you said that you keep a spreadsheet of what you've worn to like events and stuff.
I do.
Do you still do that?
Yeah, I keep a spreadsheet of all the outfits I've ever worn. Okay, so this is, there's a couple of reasons why I do this. Number one is because I love a spreadsheet. I mean,
sure.
I mean, forget foreplay. Just let me. And so I love a spreadsheet. Number two, it saves me a massive amount of time when, you know, you get invited to something, you think, oh, what am I going to wear? But I'm filming all day, or I'm doing this all day, or whatever. So it does all of that. But also as well, because I, like everybody else, and I think people think that I've got the key to body confidence and the key to personal self-esteem happiness, but I just don't. I'm like everybody else. And so there are certain outfits that I've worn that I know I felt good in. And so for me, it makes perfect sense to log that, to know, actually, it's like, you know, turning around and saying, well, I love a roast dinner, so let's have a roast dinner. And so for me, my wardrobe's a little bit like that. So if I log everything, and I know I'm having a bit of a particularly shitty day with how I feel about myself, or like everybody else does, then I know that I can just call on the spreadsheet and turn around and say, well, actually, you felt great in that outfit, so we'll just wear that one. And it works.
That's brilliant. Well, I sort of do that with clothes for stage. There's certain shirts that I have great gigs in, or certain suits that I'm like, I felt great that day.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I get that, but I don't keep it in a spreadsheet, but maybe I should.
Can I give you a little tip, Susan?
Please do.
Free fashion tips now.
Oh, this is great.
Another thing I do without fail, regardless of how hammered I am at the weekend, on a Sunday, I will always set up my outfits for the week. So I'll go through my diary and work out, well, you've got, you know, that meeting, you're filming there, you're doing this, you're seeing friends, whatever. And I work out all my outfits and I rack them all up in a long line down my wardrobes and I photograph them. And then they all get put into my phone. So I will know on Wednesday evening when I'm doing that, what I'm wearing on the Sunday.
I love that.
Are you turned on?
I loved it. I am a little bit, yeah. Mainly because I dress quite androgynously. I feel like I could really go into your wardrobe and have a great time. I feel like, yeah, I'll take that as well. That's great.
Well, I dress really androgynously as well. So, I mean, we could just share.
Okay, that's it. Okay, the podcast is over. I'm coming round. That's it.
Style, actually, Susie. I've got to say, and I obviously follow you on social media. I've met you several times. I've even seen you perform. And I do love your style. I love the way that you somehow find humour in what you're wearing, but it's never funnier than what's coming out of your mouth.
Oh, that's one of my favourite compliments I've ever had. Thank you for that.
Are you blushing?
A little bit, yeah, I am.
I've turned you on and I've made you blush.
Oh my God. Wait, this can't be a podcast talking about being gay, because by the end of it, I'm going to be I'm going to be betrothed to Gok Wan. I mean, what a turnout for the books. Now, you spoke about growing up on a council estate. You grew up in Leicester, is that right?
That's right, Leicester.
Now, your dad owns a restaurant, doesn't he?
He did. Multiple restaurants and takeaways, never more than one at a time. So they weren't like huge empires. But we all brought up in catering, basically. So Chinese restaurants and then takeaways. And finally, the last business they had before they retired a few years ago was a fish and chip shop. So always grown up around food, but around work and the business and the family and stuff like that. It was a great upbringing, but tough. It was a really tough upbringing.
Because you...
Lots of things. Being gay was really tough. Being mixed race was very tough, and being mixed race Asian was really tough because we were the only Asian family on our estate, pretty much.
Right. And in your school as well, were you some of the only Asian children there?
Yes. I mean, that I remember. I mean, it's so hazy. It's one of those things, you know, I really hated my childhood. I shouldn't really say that. I didn't hate all of my childhood. I loved my time with my family. I loved growing up in a business. I was a really happy kid until about 10 or 11. And then it all kind of, the shit hit the fan. It all got a bit miserable. And so I've kind of blocked out a lot of the stuff. And a lot of people say, go and have therapy, rediscover. I'm like, why would you want to live that shit again? No, thanks.
Dealt with and it's in the past.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy it the first time round. I'm not going in for a second helping. And so I think that we pretty much were the only Asian family that I remember anyway. So for lots of different reasons, it was just quite a tough place to be. You know, my parents went through a lot of racism when they got together because of my dad being Chinese, mum being English. And I think we might have inherited some of that a little bit, because I remember hearing about it and my mum speaking about it when we were very young. So it makes you very aware of that kind of stuff. And then, you know, and I had a really, really tough time coming out because I'm naturally quite camp. I'm naturally quite flamboyant. And also I was 21 stone. So you can imagine I was like a smorgasbord for the bullies. It came in from every direction. They just nibbled on me throughout the day.
And I heard you say as well that you sort of became flamboyant. Was that to deal with bullies, so that you got there first?
I had a kind of real epiphany very, very early on, is that the only place that I felt comfortable at school, because I'm not that clever.
I think that's not true. I think that
That's the honest truth.
Similar to me. You're not academic, but you've got to be clever.
I'm a great salesman. I could sell anything. That's the thing.
But how would someone that's not clever be able to like create Isolation Nation, do all these things, raise all this money? You're just clever in a different way.
It's all luck. The whole thing is luck. What I mean is I'm not clever, as in I am. Okay, that's a lie. I'm being massively self-deprecating because it's easy. But my sister's really academic, as in the brightest person I know. I'm not into sports. And so kind of, when you're back in those days as well in the 80s, it was either, you're either clever or you did sports. You kind of didn't do anything else. It was that type of thing. But I found a really warm, safe place in the drama studio. And at a very, very young age, I kind of worked out that I could stand on stage. I found it really difficult to be in a classroom. I found it really difficult to be in the school corridors or in the playground. But I found it very easy to be on stage. It didn't scare me. And in fact, I enjoyed the rush of being anybody other than me, and I worked that out very, very young. And so I took drama as an option, and at the same time I also asked to be in the school pantomime, which was, the irony is I do pantomime for a living. After being in the school pantomime, and I got cast as typically typecast as not as Prince Charming, I know you're shocked, but as Dandini, the camp sidekick. And I literally fell in love with Dandini. I've got a picture of it, actually. I'll send it to you, Susie. I'll text it to you. I've got a picture of me standing on stage as Dandini. And I remember borrowing a girl's trousers, these wide leg black palazzo pants with massive polka dots on. And I had this huge oversized shirt, and I had a polka dot cravat wrapped around my neck, and I wore blusher and lipstick and eyeshadow, and my hair was in a kiss curl. And Dandini was just the most incredible person I've ever met in my entire life, because he was allowed to be flamboyant, and that's what got him love and attention. And he was allowed to be funny, and that's what got him love and attention. And for the first time ever, I suppose Dandini became my confidant and my friend, because I then wasn't afraid of being gay just whilst I was Dandini, which lasted only for 3 nights, believe it or not. And it wasn't until much later on that I had worked all this stuff out. But he was the most incredible person, and he allowed me to be flamboyant. And in fact, the more flamboyant I was, the more laughter and the more cheer and the more joy in the audience faces. And it was a real opening of my sexuality, and me coming out was the first thing that happened to me, really.
And do you think that, because I didn't have a very nice time at school either, I mean, it wasn't awful, but I just didn't enjoy it, and I was just not comfortable in my own skin and constantly trying to be someone else. And I did lots and lots of drama as well. And I felt like, and I don't know if you'll agree with this, when you're on stage, you sort of have control of it.
Yeah.
Because everyone's looking at you and you're going, well, I've got the control now. You can't say anything about me.
Yeah.
Because I'm the one that's got a mic on. And I think it's even the same now with me doing stand-up. I'll say everything that someone could think to say about me before they've had a chance to say it.
Yeah.
And then I'm in control.
Yeah, I do agree with that. And I think that absolutely that does translate into your adult life. You know, when I'm working now, even, if I'm dressing somebody on camera, I'm still very much in control. And for me, it was less about getting in there first and being self-deprecating. It was more about, if you come at me right now, so when I was at school, so things like, being tripped up, being poked, have names called it, this stuff happened daily. It was a barrel. Mm. It was like warfare, basically, in the playground. And when that stuff kind of happens, the only defense you've got is either to walk away from that or stand up for yourself. Now, I didn't know what standing up for myself meant, because I didn't understand my sexuality. I wasn't out by then. I was still coming to terms. I hadn't been with anybody. I didn't know really what I was doing. So I couldn't defend it, and I couldn't stand up for it because I didn't understand it. But when I was on stage, these people weren't allowed to do that, because if I was, Dandini, for instance, then Dandini would have a line, and Dandini would be able to stop it there and then, because that person is sat there watching you. Their role in this performance is to be your audience. Do you see what I mean?
And yeah, absolutely.
That's what gave me full control. But it only lasted for three nights. And so then afterwards, I had to then go back to my normal world. And I hadn't worked any of this stuff. I wasn't bright enough to work out that's what was happening. But I was definitely a different person after falling in love with Dandini, without question, because I knew that out there were real life Dandinis. There were real people that were willing to accept me and allow me to be me and allow my flamboyance and my big personality to be a plus and not necessarily be something that stopped me from being like everybody else.
It's something to be celebrated.
Susie, this is very deep. I thought we were going to talk about fish. Or
no, I'm sorry. We've spoken about your fish jug and now we're getting right into it.
Hurry up. Stop this.
So what did your mum and dad know that you were having a tough time at school?
No, I kept it all from them. They were having a really tough time with their business. By which time we had moved out of our council house and we'd gone to live above a restaurant. And the restaurant, you know, it was the 80s and there was the recession and it was really, really tough for business. And I watched my dad, you know, really struggle and go from a beautifully flamboyant and charismatic restaurant owner to somebody that was really afraid of losing his business. And so I just felt that I couldn't put any more on them because they were struggling so much. And so I became very isolated, very isolation nation on my own. Mm-hmm. And because I was still, a majority of it was to do with my sexuality. Even though being fat was a problem, I had the tools and the language and the comedy to beat that away. That was fine. Being mixed race was kind of all right because, you know, I kind of dealt with that and we didn't really get too much pressure because of our race. But the gay stuff was tough because I didn't know anybody gay and I didn't know I didn't know the language around it. And to be honest with you, at that point, I had not confirmed it physically. So it might have been just a fantasy in my brain. I had no idea at all. And so it was the gay stuff that was tough. And I couldn't talk to mum and dad about it because they're not gay. And my brother, they're not gay. So who the hell, you talk to people that are like-minded that are going through the same thing. And, you know, we didn't have the internet back then and we didn't have all that stuff. So I remember creeping into this true story. We had a pub in Leicester called the Pineapple and it was opposite the bus station, slightly out of town, almost like a viaduct, I suppose. And it was, and I'd heard about this gay pub.
And how old are you at this point?
Oh my God, how old was I? Probably 14-ish.
Okay, so quite young, okay.
But I kind of knew I was gay by then. By then, fantasy had set in. Matt Goss was the lead in my porn in my head. And occasionally Luke, depending on what mood I was in. and I remember creeping into the pub. And you know, back in those days, all gay pubs, there was no sign saying, this is a gay pub. You know, it was kind of blacked out windows. And, you know, it was supposed to look like a traditional pub, but it was all kind of blacked out. It was a bit weird. But there was always a door open. To get in, and they'd always put the free magazines out and flyers and stuff. And I remember going in there and nicking one of the free mags and just having this magazine and thinking, oh my God, what happens behind those closed doors? This is amazing. This is like Club Tropicana, you know, where everyone's going to be this beautiful. And, you know, now, little did I know later on, many years later, I go into the Pineapple, nothing like the fucking magazine. Let down, nothing like it. But that was kind of, you know, and so but that's what you did back then, I guess, when you don't have internet and you don't have, you know, your mobile phone, you can search for stuff, which makes me sound prehistoric now. But of course, you know, we didn't have any of those resources. The resources were magazines in shops or wherever you would find it. And in my case, it was the Pineapple Pub in Leicester. And so that was probably my slight entree into the gay scene, very, very slightly. But I didn't come out until much later, actually.
So you moved to London after school, is that right, to go to Central?
Yes, I did. But then I had a big moment. So I left school really early. So at 15 years old, I got booted out for being a tearaway.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That surprises me for being a tearaway. I mean,
well, no, awful. Well, see, that you kind of had two ways. Well, in my mind, I guess, you know, this is all said with hindsight, and I think hindsight is massively incorrect, because you just kind of remember the glossy, beautiful, flowery moments. But
and you remember everything like it's a story, like it was all leading to this. But some things are just shit. You know, people say what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and you think, yeah, but when people say, oh, it's character building, you think, oh, I feel like my character's built. Do I have to keep going to school?
So I had two ways to go. The bullying got pretty horrific at school, but I had two ways to go. I could either take the bullying every single day, or I could become the aggressor. I could become not necessarily the bully, because I'd never pick on another person. Even back then, I mean, it's kind of my biggest hate is bullies. I hate them more than anything else. But I guess that I was a little bit like an emotional Robin Hood. I was kind of looking after everybody else. It was a bit like that. And so what happened was my grades started to fall very quickly, and I started to get into trouble because I'd worked out that if you're in a room of people, your peers and your community, now if you do something which you're not supposed to do, it makes people laugh. Mm-hmm. Do stuff that's slightly controversial. It makes people laugh. And so I remember back then, it was things like Victoria Wood and Judy Walters,
yes,
and Girls on Top, French and Saunders. And I remember watching these programs and picking up these one-liners and like being desperate to get to school so I could drop these one-liners. And I remember this. I remember doing it and almost collecting, cataloguing this humour inside my head. And so I got into loads of trouble because I was as gobby and loud and mischievous. And the more naughty I was, the more people laughed. And it made me feel liked. It made me feel loved. It made me forget about the bullies. And the bullies couldn't come near me when they were laughing because all of
yes.
them, they were, I was on side with them. And even though they never liked me, I was just became this clown. You know, without the makeup and without the stupid hat and the hair, but I was still this clown, and the clowning around got me into a lot of trouble. So I got booted out of school and put onto an extended work experience, which was basically expelled. But to save the
right.
I'm sure to save the paperwork, I started working for my dad's restaurant, and I then got into a really terrible crowd and kind of, you know, did all the stuff that I shouldn't have done. And started raving and going to illegal all-night warehouse raves and, you know, doing all that kind of thing. But it was an mm-hmm. incredible experience in my life, which is probably where the DJing comes from now, is that I found house music for me was a real saviour, because all of a sudden it didn't matter I was gay, even though I hadn't come out. It didn't matter that
yes.
I was fat, didn't matter that I was mixed race. I was just in a room full of people that were there to listen to the music and just joining in their general euphoria together. And I felt completely, for the first time in my life, like I belonged to something. And I belong to the house music movement. And so it's always been very, very dear to me, very special to me. But then very quickly, I knew that I had to get out of that scene. I couldn't spend the rest of my life, you know, doing the, you know, the shoplifting and doing all that stuff. And so I went to college to go and do performing arts because I remembered Dandini. And I remember having this moment of standing in Leicester Town Centre in my Le Click tracksuit, my Travel Fox trainers. And I remember thinking, you've got to do something about this shit. You have got to do something. And I was really young. I was like 16, 17. And so I walked down to the local college and I knocked on the drama studio door, expecting the drama studio to feel exactly the same as the drama studio at school. And of course it wasn't. It was a completely different space. And there was two women there, a woman called Dean and a woman called Liz. And at the time they were together, a couple, but they ran the performing arts course. And I stood there and I just broke down in tears. And I said, just help me. I don't know what to do with my life. And I'm still good friends with Dean now.
Oh, wow.
And just aced it for 3 years there. Aced it, which is where I came out actually at college there. Do you want to hear the coming out?
I mean, if you want to, yeah. Where was that? So you were at college, you're doing performing arts.
Probably about a year in now. And I...
Are you still raving and misbehaving?
No, I'd missed. So I'd walked away from the raving. I couldn't do both. I couldn't be at my raves at the weekend. And I was good at this skill. I was good at being in the drama studio. I was good at arts management. I kind of understood it. I was even mm-hmm. quite good at dancing, believe it or not. And
I can believe it.
Well, you know, it's larger than life character. And so, and I was kind of doing really well. For the first time in my life, I felt like I had a purpose. And then Take That were around. And I remember we sat in the school refectory and I'd ordered my triple sausage sandwich for my breakfast that I had every single day, Susie. And I ordered this and the people on my course were sat there and somebody started talking. Someone said, oh, have you seen him? His name's Gary. He's the hottest. And somebody else said, no, it's Howard. Another person said, it's Jason. And I literally blurted out, it's Mark. Mark's the fittest. Mark is the hottest. And that's how I came out. Was like, through Take That, thanks very much, Take That. And they kind of all just looked at me as if to say, we knew, it's fine.
Yeah.
And that was, it was the most underwhelming coming out experience anybody could experience. But it felt like it was such a relief that all of a sudden people knew. But I didn't tell my family until many years after.
So did you then go to the Pineapple, do you think? Was it then that you were like, okay, yeah. Well, I've done it?
Yeah. So then in my third year, so it was two courses that lasted 3 years. And then towards the end of the third year, end of the second year, I started to then hit the gay scene in Leicester. I'd found my confidence and mm-hmm. kind of told, you know, the people that needed to know in my life, none of which were my family, by the way.
Not your siblings either, just...
No, I told my sister first, but a little bit later on. Mm-hmm. And we started hitting the gay scene and it was remarkable. We had an incredible club in Leicester called Street Life. I remember standing on a podium and by which time I'd become even more flamboyant. And I remember one outfit that I wore was a silver sarong skirt with massive, like, buffalo boots, like, you know, spice.
Yeah, I remember buffalo boots.
I had a white shirt on and a red and white check jacket. I mean, I'm still 21 stone. You imagine there was a lot of fabric, a lot of body to cover, and a red and white check suit. And then I had this huge, enormous, almost dinner plate size sunflower attached to the jacket. I mean, again, quite clownish, but I enjoyed, you know, the attention. I enjoyed, you know, being flamboyant and out there, which is probably where the fashion comes from now.
Yeah, I was going to say, were you into fashion then? Were you into what you were wearing, or did that come later?
I guess. I mean, no, not really. I mean, I didn't. I mean, that's a whole different story, honestly, Susie. There's so many stories. A whole different story how I got into fashion. Probably not into fashion then. I just knew that I found this community of people where they couldn't give a fuck whether I was, you know, mixed race Chinese or fat or gay. And they just didn't care. They just kind of liked me for who I was. And so I was able to dial up my flamboyance and my campness and all of the stuff that made me smile. And, you know, and having clothes on that were brightly coloured and out there and no one else was wearing made me happy. And this community accepted me. And it was the most, you know, and I love those people still. I don't see hardly any of them anymore, ever actually. But these people were the most welcoming people in the entire world, and they were brilliant. You know, they were lesbian and trans and gay and bisexual, and however they wanted to identify, they were just brilliant people. And it felt amazing to be part of that community. And then I decided that I was going to move to London then, and I decided that I was going to audition for the Central School of Speech and Drama, which is ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. Because why the hell would I ever get into the Central School of Speech and Drama? You know, probably arguably this, you know, one of the top drama schools in the world. And I'm just this, you know, this kid from Leicester. But I auditioned and I got a place. And it was for all the wrong reasons, because I got there and I wasn't good enough. And I absolutely know that now. I wasn't a strong enough performer and I didn't belong there. And I wasn't stable enough and I wasn't confident enough to be in this place, and had an absolutely terrible time. And then within 12 months, lost half of my body weight and was diagnosed with severe anorexia.
Wow. So you're really flamboyant. You've just sort of accepted who you are. You've got this group around you that make you feel great about yourself.
Yeah.
And then you go to London, and I guess assuming that it's going to be this like wonderland, like, you know, because I'm not from London either. And I feel like when I was growing up, London just felt like the most exciting, wonderful place in the world, and I couldn't wait to get there.
I remember watching ITN News years ago, and you see a graphic of Westminster Bridge with Big Ben in the background. I remember thinking, one day I'm going to live there. And it was a land of dreams, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
There was lots of things that happened during those 3 years that I've spoken about. So it's not like I don't want to talk about it, it's just we're going to run out of time. Lots of things that happened. One terrible incident that made me very, very scared, where I was threatened very badly by a group of people in Leicester and got told that I'd be killed and stuff like that. And so
this, oh my God.
And I found this world that I was super happy and confident in, and I was doing well at something, and I was good enough to be there. And then all of a sudden this incident happened that made me, and I'm not going to say agoraphobic, but there's not another word for it, but I was really afraid of going out. There were certain parts of Leicester that I wouldn't allow myself to go in case they were there. There were certain roads that I wasn't allowed to drive down in case they were there. And so I've given myself all of these, I used to call them green and red areas. So green areas were okay at certain parts of the day, but then they would turn into a red area, and then I couldn't go near it in case they were there, because I genuinely thought they were going to kill me. And that was to do with being gay.
And so London must have appealed even more then.
Absolutely.
So you were like, right, I'm getting out of here.
Is it? I mean, London was where, I mean, it's where gay people are.
Absolutely. I'm here, you're here. We're all here.
That's where performers are. That's where, you know, I was searching again for Dandini. I was searching for flamboyant people that I knew that I could be around. And when I arrived in London, of course, it wasn't like that. You know, London's a tough place to be in. I didn't feel in danger like I did for a long time in Leicester. But all of a sudden, I had a whole new set of cards to deal with. And those cards were that I just wasn't good enough to be there. I was surrounded by these very beautiful, very brilliant, very creative, very talented performers that had spent, you know, that they'd read Keats and Shakespeare and Dickens, and they knew this and knew that. And I didn't know any of that stuff. I was on a performing arts course in Leicester where we, you know, we did contemporary dance. And, you know, I think the last show that I did was was cabaret or something. So all of a sudden, I'm surrounded by these very, very brilliant people. And I just didn't fit in. I wasn't strong enough to be there.
So did you leave the course?
Yes. Well, I kind of had to. I was so ill with the anorexia. So I decided, so go back and go backwards slightly. I failed very, very quickly. I'd never written an essay up until then, because my performing arts courses were very practical. So I'd never actually, I didn't know how to write an essay. And don't forget, I'd left school at 15 without any GCSEs. So actually my writing and my reading wasn't very strong either. And so I then was failing terribly. But I kind of worked out in my head, and I remember I had this real moment. I stood on the stairs of the Embassy Theatre, the front of the Central School of Speech and Drama, the very famous steps with all their names written on, French and Saunders, all these people. And I stood on these steps and I thought, I've got it. If I look like everybody else, if I behave like everybody else, then I'll be good. And so, of course, it's because you're fat, it's because you're overweight. And if you look like everybody else, then everyone's going to accept you and you'll be clever and brilliant and you'll be a great performer, because I wanted desperately to be there. And so I put myself on a diet and I started dieting. And within a matter of weeks, I'd kind of dieted and dieted. And then by the end of it, I was only eating 3 teaspoons of honey a day, because I'd kind of mentally worked out that was enough carbohydrate, that was enough sugar for me to do a full day, which of course it wasn't.
No, of course. So you must have been so ill.
Really ill, really, really, really ill. And then I had to leave the course because I physically wasn't strong enough. I mentally wasn't strong enough either. And I had to go back to Leicester to the place that I was terrified of. I had to go back there to be with my family that then repaired me and get myself better again. And they did. And they were, you know, incredible people and all of that stuff happened.
And I'm sure, like so many people that have, like, you know, interviewed you before have said this, but it's so interesting that you've been through that journey with your own body to then, you know, have a show like How to Look Good Naked.
Yeah.
Because you really understand it from so many perspectives, because you've sort of lived in two bodies.
Yeah, it kind of makes perfect sense to me. You know, when I'm working with somebody now, and you know, I do this on a daily basis, and I am standing in front of a mirror with them normally, and it's usually a woman, and she's upset and she's crying and she's saying, you know, I can't take the kids swimming because I'm so afraid of what the other mums might think of my body in a swimsuit. Or they say, you know, I get petrified of going to the school gates with the kids because I don't want people to judge me. Or they turn around and say, you know, I can't have sex with my partner, or I don't want my partner to see me naked. You know, all these things that I've heard repeatedly over the last 20 years I've been a stylist, in particular a makeover stylist. And so when somebody says that, it's almost as if, okay, so it's hard to imagine this, but can you imagine, just put your fingers into a cage onto your chest and pull at the skin. It feels like that. It feels like that. My entire chest plate opens when I hear somebody talk like that. And that might sound like I'm exaggerating, but I'm genuinely not. It feels like every part of me is exposed when I hear somebody like that. And so I think, because I've been there and I've looked in the mirror and I've contemplated suicide because I thought that was the only thing that was going to make me feel better, and I have starved myself regardless of how much it damaged my relationship with my friends and my family, I still did that searching for happiness. So when somebody tells me they hate the way that they look with every single part of their body, it rips open my chest and I can feel it. And I think that, you know, I'm not the best stylist in the world. I'm not the best presenter in the world. I know all of this stuff. I'm not the most intelligent person in the world. But what I am good at is I'm really good at empathy, because I know what that feels like.
But I think that's what makes you so good. I think that's the thing. Like, I think the reason, like, so you're like my auntie's favourite person. She was so excited that I was chatting to you today. I speak to my mum every morning and I said to mum, oh, I'm interviewing Gok this afternoon. She went, oh my God, I can't wait to ring Jackie. Oh my God, I can't wait to ring Jackie. Because I think that what your talent is that your warmth comes through the screen, that there are women that have, you know, watched your shows and listened to what you've said to other women, and they've heard it themselves. And it's the truth and the honesty and the fact that, you know, that you've had a journey to get there, and people can tell that you really care. It's not just a makeover show. It's a show about life, about acceptance, about embracing who you are.
It's so interesting because this, towards the end of last year, so we haven't made How to Look Naked in years and years and years.
No, it's been a while, hasn't it?
A while, but then last year, I got asked to reboot the show again, which we did do. We made it. And I kind of ummed and ahed with whether it was right for me, because it's a very difficult show for me to make. I'm saying all this stuff like I'm some kind of, yeah, I've got the tools and I know what I'm doing. But of course, you know, it's hugely damaging. Years ago when we made House Look Good Naked, I would have therapy whilst making the show, because of course it opens up all the skeletons and all those cupboards in my head that I've packed stuff away.
Yeah, when something resonates that closely with you, you can't help but revisit
exactly
and when, things that have happened.
When you're making multiple episodes of one series and you're dealing with lots of different people, you know, and you're taking on all of their stuff, you know, you have to absorb it like a sponge, and so it doesn't go anywhere. And so I went to therapy to get rid of it so it didn't damage me too much. But then this year, and then I decided I was going to make the show again. And it suddenly dawned on me, making the show after all the, I mean, we made the first episode in 2006. Now, 2020, 14 years later, we're rebooting the show. And
that's so exciting.
Really exciting, very, very scary. But it suddenly made me realize that actually I've made so much television post How to Look Good Naked. That I am in a far more educated position about how television works and marketing and, you know, kind of the process and all that kind of stuff, that I kind of suddenly realised that actually How to Look Good Naked is never making a programme. I don't care where the cameras are. I don't care if my mic's, you know, working or not. I'm not thinking about the edit after the end of the day, which is what I do on normal show, on other shows.
Yeah.
Because this show, I've only got one objective, and that is to get that person well, to get that person loving themselves, to get that person feeling good about themselves. And so in How to Look Good Naked is that program. And so we just by chance have a camera crew. It just happened to be recorded. That does happen, but that show is real. The success rate is real. My intention is to make that person feel better, regardless of her shape or size or disability or whatever I'm working with. I don't give a shit. You know, my job is to make you love yourself, and I'm going to do that. You know, I set out that goal. And so it's a very interesting process to go through, especially from somebody that's been in such dark places with their body and their identity and feeling very unloved and very unliked and not good enough and very unclever and all of that stuff. It's a very, very odd position to be in, because should I make that program? Probably not. But do I make it, and is it a success? Yes, it is, for that reason. But it's a bit of an odd one.
So at what point did you realise that you had this skill with, well, I guess with people? Because that must be part of the job. Because I've never had a stylist.
Right.
And part of it, I'm guessing, is making that person feel great. If they're going to an event or you're doing someone for an awards thing, they need to feel really great in what they're wearing.
Yeah, it kind of happened before the fashion, actually. I've always had an affinity with women. I've always really enjoyed the female psyche. And my majority of my social group is female. Mm-hmm. And the people that I go to when I need help would be female as well. And so because of that, I naturally care. I care about how they feel about stuff, and I enjoy the conversation and the language that comes with being a woman. That's just been me the whole of my life. And that's nothing to do with being gay, by the way. That's to do with me being me as a person. Mm-hmm. And so I've always enjoyed that. But years and years ago, so leaving Central, getting better from anorexia, moving back to London, I'm now working in a gay restaurant in London, Valens.
Oh, I know Valens. I love Valens.
And so I'm there. And at the time, my flatmate at the time was a singer, and I'd gone to Central with her, and she'd just got a single deal. And my flatmate is getting her hair and makeup done to go to work on her music video that day. And the whole time I'm getting ready, I'm kind of watching her hair and makeup being done, thinking, I could do that. And all day long, I thought about it, you know, the makeup and everything else. And I got home that night and I said to my flatmate, you know, what was the director like? How many times did you have to sing the song? What did you have to wear? What did you have to do? And also, how much did your makeup artist get paid? And she told me 50 quid. And I thought, fucking hell, one day I'm going to earn 50 quid a day. Okay, I'm going to do that. And so basically, I blagged my way. This is a really long story, so I'm going to cut it short. I blagged my way into a hair and makeup agency. And so I bowl into this agency, and I basically tell them that I am a hair and makeup artist. I've been working out in New York. I don't have a portfolio because it's with a director in LA for a film. And I would love to join the agency.
Oh, I love the blag.
Yeah, the blag. And so I did all this stuff. So obviously, I did learn something at drama school. And anyway, a couple of days later, they call me and I flip my phone. It was a Sony Ericsson. It's back in the day.
Oh, very cool back then.
Thank you very much. And they've got this job for me, and it's to do all of the British polo players' wives for a feature in a magazine. And I'm like, okay, fine. And so I didn't have any kit, had no makeup brushes, had no makeup. I couldn't do it. So I basically had to black all of this makeup, and I had 2 days to learn how to do makeup. And I was so shit. I was so bad at it. And I rock up to this job, and I'm doing the women's makeup, never having done makeup in my life before. And it was terrible. I mean, they had eyebrows where their hair was done
up. Like, why is everyone so surprised, Gok?
Literally, and like orange jawline. I mean, the full works. But it didn't matter because I made all these women feel really comfortable in my chair, and I chatted and I made them laugh, and, you know, kind of made them feel really warm. And that's the first time I realised, oh, actually, you can do something like this. You've got a skill here. And it isn't necessarily the skill that I then obviously taught myself. I was, you know, became quite a successful makeup artist in the day. That stuff you can teach yourself. It's craft, it's skill. But what nobody can teach you is how to make somebody feel good about themselves when they're in a vulnerable position. And when you're about to have your picture taken, or you're about to go and sing a song on stage, or you're about to shoot your music video, you want to have a team around you that make you feel good about yourselves. And so I then went on to have quite a successful career as a makeup artist, and then fashion stylist before TV happened.
So at that point, were you into clothes? Because you're so, like, when I've seen you out and about, you're so stylish.
I'm really not. Well, Susie, honestly, I'm the worst. You know, they always say hairdressers have the worst hair and stylists have the worst clothes. I kind of agree with that, because, you know, my job is to make everybody else feel beautiful. I've always been fascinated by clothes, but it's never been about trend for me. I've really enjoyed, and from a very early age, I remember my sister coming home from school, and my sister's kind of my idol, and she still is now. I absolutely adore my sister. And I remember her coming home from school in the 80s, and she would then go up to her room and get changed, and within moments she would have transformed from a schoolgirl in her uniform all of a sudden into this goth with this massive quiff and oversized earrings and oversized men's jacket, tube skirt, brogues, you know. And it was just, I was remember being fascinated by how the caterpillar effect of clothing can turn you into
transform you.
And so from a very early age I knew the power of clothing. I hadn't logged it until much later on in my life. And so I've always been obsessed with what clothing does to the psyche, you know, how we project ourselves onto other people, the conversations that we have without words, just by the clothes that we use. You know, the reason why you use your shirts for work, the reason why you use a suit, the reason why you describe yourself as androgynous, the reason why you have your hair cut the way you do. You know, all of those things I'm really interested in, that the psychology of fashion. So it was never about what is the best cut this season or what is the best shoot. It was about what do we do? What are the messages we give out to other people by the clothes that we wear? And how powerful are them? Because if you can deter an argument, or if you could convey the most incredible political message by the clothes that you're wearing, and you're doing all of that without language, how incredible would that be to be able to harness that and use it for good?
So what are your clothes saying? Not necessarily today, but when you go out, what is it that you're trying to say with your clothes?
So my clothing is pretty much, I need people to know I know what I'm talking about. But
right.
Also, I...
And your glasses as well.
Yeah, my glasses are a statement. I like things. Do you know, whenever I'm having a shit clothing day, I've got a couple of images inside my head that I always go back to. One is of Diane Keaton wearing a full suit.
Oh, I know, exactly. Yep, love it, love it, love it.
I think of Tilda Swinton. Always.
Yes, yes, yes.
So I've got these kind of references inside my head. But then I've created a character who is a little bit like a Southeast Asian architect. He's kind of wearing disconnected, slightly oversized, slightly uniform, utilitarian clothing. And so my clothing's around that slightly. I'm almost like a funeral director for the wardrobe.
I'm sorry, this top is not going to make it. I'm sorry. It's been on life support for a while. The last time you took it out, it did not look well. We've made the decision.
So, yeah, kind of that's how I describe my style, really. But I kind of, you know, oddly, I used to be very, very concerned about what I look like. And when I first you know, went onto television, I you know, the papers would talk about you and you'd be photographed and the paps would be following you and stuff like that. I was really concerned, but I wanted just people to like me. It's that age old thing, you know, still searching for Gandini. But as I've got older, you know, I'm 46 this year. I've never been happier. I've never been more confident with who I am as a person. I really trust what comes out of my mouth now. I really trust my politics and my ethics, and I stand for what I believe in. And if I don't, I won't say anything. So all this stuff that I've learned, so actually my clothes now, but bizarrely become less important to me because my mind is doing that job now. I don't need the uniform as much.
And what do you think's got you there to knowing yourself that bit better? Is it because the sort of work success? Because I mean, you've had like a really impressive career.
Thank you.
Like there's, you've done loads. Everyone knows who you are. Everyone that, like, I know people that know you, everyone likes you. Like our industries sort of occasionally cross over and everyone's always got a kind word to say about you.
Oh, that's right.
Like, what do you think has got you to that stage where you do feel like you don't need this sort of armor of your uniform anymore?
Do you know what? I worked out quite a while ago now. But actually, for a long time, I was always searching for happiness because I wanted people to like me. I wanted people to accept me. I wanted to be validated. And that comes from the bullies and it comes from Dandini. Mm-hmm. And it comes from, you know, that awful incident in Leicester and even leaving drama school. All of that stuff was about validation. And I realized, you know, quite a while ago now that actually I just needed to accept myself. And if I accept who I am, and this is going to sound like this is going to sound like the biggest bag of cheese crisps you've ever eaten in your entire life.
I'm ready. The bag's open. Feed them to me.
I do genuinely believe that if I'm a good person and I am kind to other people, that's enough for me. And so if I'm doing a good job, if I'm looking after my friends, if I'm looking after my family, and I'm not saying that I love everyone because I don't, because some people I really fucking hate. But, you know, for the people that in my life that I want to be a good person, I want to be kind and I want to be less judgmental and all that other stuff. If I'm a good person, then I'm going to feel good about myself. And it is genuinely the truth. You know, yesterday I had a really, really tough morning. I woke up and I wasn't even hungover. I woke up and I just was like, what, are we still in this? Are we still doing? I want to see my family. I want to see my friends. And I was in the shittiest mood you could ever imagine. It doesn't happen that often anymore. And I kind of, and I felt it creeping up, and it was almost like, you know, when you froth a coffee and you put in too much and you kind of know that it's going to go over the top, but you still keep on pouring. It was like I was pouring all of this frothy milk into this coffee and I couldn't stop it from over pouring. And so what I did is I wrote a really simple statement and put it onto my Instagram account. And it was just really honest. It was like I'd had a really shit morning. And so I've just done some breathing. I've done some smiling. I've just remembered I've got to be grateful for my friends and family. And it's because I thought to myself, actually, there's going to be millions of people that feel that shit in that morning, but maybe they haven't got the tool or the device to get themselves out of it. So if I share my tool, it might help. And it just blew up, thousands and thousands of messages and stuff of people saying, thanks very much, that really helped me this morning, I'm having a really tough time. And so I think it's about that. That's made me a happier person. Use my personality, not my status, not my job, not what I do, not my, you know, I hate words, but fame or popularity. None of that stuff means anything to me. I don't care about it. I care about being a good person and making sure that when people do talk about me, that they do say they've only got nice things to say because I'm a nice person. And if someone does say something about me that it isn't very nice, they're probably a dickhead.
Well, I can tell you I've only ever heard such things about you.
You've not spoken to my family.
So oh no, we've got your dad on afterwards. He's coming on after.
Oh, Papa One.
We've got Papa One on.
Oh, Papa One, I love him.
So the final question that I ask everyone when they come on the show is if you could pick up like a telephone, one of those 80s ones that have still got the curly cord, and ring Little Gok, and let's say when you'd had that 3 days of playing Dandini.
Yeah.
And but then you had to go back to life.
Mm-hmm.
What advice would you give him about what's to come?
This is a really difficult answer because I think it's slightly dangerous. I'm going to be very honest, Susie, because I think if you were to go back and tell your former self, then you wouldn't be the person that you are. But I'm going to play the game anyway.
That's true. That is true. Okay. Well, then if you had to give him a bit of encouragement, then let's not say advice today. Let's say encouragement.
But I'd say to Little Gok, do you know what? Stop worrying about everything. because everything is going to be all right. You're an all right person. You know, you're not the best at everything and you don't have to be already. And instead of trying to prove to the world how good you are at stuff that you don't understand, why don't you just let the world know that you're there? And that's enough right now. You don't need to do any more than that because you've got a long time ahead of you to do all the other stuff.
That's perfect. Gok, thank you so much. I know that you're so, so busy at the moment and I really appreciated that conversation.
Thanks for having me on.
There we are. What a fantastic conversation. I absolutely love Gok and I'm, of course, absolutely delighted that he thinks that I'm stylish. What a joy. What a joy to chat to him. What a joy to make this series this year. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back in 2021. Until then, look after yourself. Bye.